There is an endless supply of financial planning advice out there to warn Americans that if we don't put money away for retirement, we will suffer for it later in life. Of course, in some parts of the world, children grow up watching their parents support their grandparents and are raised with the understanding that they will someday meet their own parents' expenses. But what about people who live in the United States where we do things one way, but have cultural ties to a place where the rules around this stuff are different? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Mike Dang is personal finance editor on the business desk at the New York Times, and he's the son of parents who arrived as refugees from Vietnam in 1975. They worked really hard for decades to provide for their families, but they never had the kinds of jobs that came with a benefits package or a 401k. So now their grown children are taking care of their financial needs in the Vietnamese way, even as they try to meet the expectations of U.S. economic culture. Dang wrote about this in a recent article titled, "Their Children Are Their Retirement Plans." Mike, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So it might be hard for some listeners to relate to cultural expectations and how they could create this pressure to take on a burden without any sort of official or legal obligation to do so. But I started thinking about the obligation many middle-class parents in this country feel to provide a college education for their kids. Nobody's forcing us to do it, but it absolutely is what everybody expects, and we just sort of follow.
Yes, it's just part of a cultural expectation. So when I was growing up, it wasn't, you know, something that I was surprised by becoming an adult. I just knew watching my parents that someday I was going to support them because that was what they did. And I had the same expectations. And I didn't really know how the retirement system in the U.S. worked until I graduated from college and got a job and, you know, had a job that had a 401k and retirement benefits and saw that the U.S. had an entire system of saving for the future that my parents didn't understand or have growing up or even in their adulthoods.
So if you were growing up in Vietnam or one of the many countries where everybody understands how this works there, that would be one thing. But surely it's complicated to combine those family expectations from your parents' culture with the kind of take care of yourself ethos of the United States. In a sense, folks like you are funding two generations of retirement, right? Your parents now and you yourself down the road.
That's correct. So my parents, you know, never saved a single dime for retirement because they had the expectations that their children would do it for them because, you know, they had done it for their parents. So I knew that was something that I was going to be doing, but I also recognized as I was working that I needed to save for a future because, you know, I was sort of straddling these two worlds, you know, my parents' world and their motherland and, you know, the system of retirement in the U.S. And, you know, you were constantly hearing in your jobs, in conversations with people, you know, that you have to save for your own retirement. More than half of the people in the U.S. worry about not saving for enough retirement. They feel behind. And, you know, studies have shown that by the age of 34, most people will have less than $14,000 saved in their retirement account. So people are constantly thinking about retirement as, you know, something that they really worry about and have to think about as they're working towards, you know, the retirement age of 65. So I had that in mind, you know, while trying to save for my own retirement and thinking about how to support my parents at the same time. And like you said, you know, it's sort of this obligation that you think about in the back of your mind, if you're a parent and you're trying to save for your children's college educations, that is something that I think about in the back of my mind. You know, it's not me in my 20s trying to save for my kids' college education, but it is me thinking about my parents and how to support them as they're aging.
What do you know about what it took for your folks to start over in a brand new country? I mean, that's such a, it's such a challenging act and one that takes so much energy and focus.
Right. So they had to escape the Vietnam War, and they were Vietnam War refugees who went to a resettlement camp in Savannah, Georgia, you know, in the late 70s. And they spent hours, days. I still don't quite understand it because it's very hard for them to talk about that time, but they had a very arduous journey coming to this country on a boat where there was little food, not enough water, didn't know if they were going to survive, right? So sometimes, I think, I'm in the situation where I need to support them, but, and, that has made me think about how burdensome it can be, but I have to imagine they went through some untold horrors in their own life just to get here and start a new life and have children and provide for them. And they came here not knowing the language and not having the education and not really having really anything for them except the will to survive. And so they got whatever jobs that were available to them. So my mom, like a lot of Vietnam War refugees, worked in a nail salon with other women. And my dad found work repairing cars. And this is what they did to, start a life for themselves and save money. And they eventually were able to sort of build that American dream that they didn't know existed. But, you work hard, you save money, you find a way to buy a home. And I think these days it would be much harder to do that with the sort of the work that they were doing back then. But they were able to access loans with money that they were saving. But by the time that they were able to do that, they just didn't have any money left over to save for retirement or even think about that was something that they needed to do. They didn't even know that 401ks or retirement system was possible for them. So, I do, I am very grateful for them just thinking about what they went through because I didn't have to experience any of that personally. And so I think it's something that I think about paying forward for them.
So, I want to draw a line under this. Even if your folks had wanted to put away money for themselves and their retirement, there wasn't any to spare. They were raising children, supporting their own family in this country, and then also sending money to help aging relatives themselves.
That's right. So I think these days that generation is known as the sandwich generation because they're supporting two generations on both ends, right? So they're supporting their children and they're supporting their own parents. So they were often either sending money to family back in Vietnam who needed that, or my grandparents were also refugees, at least on my mother's side, who were able to come. My grandparents on my father's side stayed in Vietnam. And so they sent my dad would send them money. But my maternal grandparents, they moved in with us when I was about middle school. And so my parents basically were supporting them in their retirement as they were aging and supporting their children too as they were growing up. So they didn't really have any money left over after, figuring out how to do both of those things.
Did you grow up often with the sense that money was tight, but it covered at least everything that you needed?
I grew up with the sense that money was tight only because I saw when I went to school, I saw children with things that I didn't have. So I didn't really understand that I didn't have the financial resources that other families had until I saw them. So I would go over to a friend's house and notice they had, books, a lot of books and furniture. And, we lived in a very sort of sparse home and didn't have a lot of those things and a lot of toys and things like that. I didn't have, so I recognized by seeing how other, Americans lived that we didn't have a lot. But I grew up in a very loving home, and I think that my parents wanted to do everything that they could for us. So a lot of the things that other children had, the toys and things like that, I didn't have, but I felt very loved, and I think that was the most important thing that they could have done for me.
Mike, You are part of this transitional generation, right? Feeling a double burden because you can't and don't assume that any kids you will have someday will take care of you financially. So maybe this is a one generation struggle, but it is not a minor one.
Right. So, you know, as a child of immigrants, I really had to learn about what it is like to live as a working person in the US. So I've had to learn about all the different ways that people think about retirement, whether it's 401ks, whether it's IRAs, whether it's just putting money into a savings account, or, you know, finding all the different ways that you build wealth and equity in this country, which is totally foreign to the way that my parents have thought about, you know, how to think about the retirement. So I really had to adjust to things. And I think that's one of the reasons why I got into personal finance, is that I've had to learn a lot of it on my own. I think a lot of people learn about money from watching how their parents do it, because I didn't, you know, really see how I could do anything that my parents were doing in sort of the American sense. I really had to learn about all the different ways that people think about retirement in the US here.
And it's not just you who will be affected by this, right? I mean, how does an obligation to financially support one's parents have to be worked out with any potential life partner, especially if the person you happen to fall in love with comes from a culture or a family that doesn't share similar expectations?
Right. So I talked to a lot of different people for this story that I wrote, and I really wanted to understand how it works in a relationship. And in general, I think that, you know, like sort of any sort of financial obligation, couples will have long, long conversations about it over time, about, you know, sort of what the obligations are and how to approach it. So in the same way that if you go into a relationship with a surprising amount of credit card debt and you reveal that to your partner, you're going to have to talk about, you know, how you're going to both deal with that debt. Are you going to deal with it as a couple? Do you expect your partner to do it on their own? And that is sort of the same conversation that some of the couples that I talk to for my story, it is a conversation like, so I, you know, one person may say, like, I come from this background where my parents expect me to send them X amount of dollars every month, or, you know, help them with their mortgage or pay for their phone bills or whatever it is. And do you want to be part of that? Do you think this is something I need to take on my own? And I think a lot of the times the couples do it together, you know, as sort of any sort of bill that they have in their lives, and they budget for it, you know, like anything else that they would do. So it is sort of switching that mind frame from, you know, I may not be coming into this relationship with all this debt from student loans or credit cards or things like that, but I am coming into a relationship with this financial obligation that we need to talk about. And I think that they have those conversations early on, especially, you know, during the dating process before they get married. I think it comes into the conversation much earlier.
Did you mention that you're still in your 20s?
I'm in my 30s
now. You're in
now.
Your 30s. Okay. Thinking about, you know, 20s and 30s are kind of like in our era, like the age of the destination wedding. And I'm curious about peer relationships. I wonder if it's ever challenging that colleagues or friends who were earning about the same amount as you ultimately have just a great deal more disposable income because they are not supporting two households on that salary.
Oh, 100%. I have peers who, you know, I had very similar career trajectories with, and they are at a point in their lives where they are able to put a down payment on a home. That is something that I've been thinking about and working on. It's going to just take me a little bit longer to buy a home or even put a down payment on a home, because the money that I would have saved for that have gone to my parents. So I do feel a little bit behind, but, you know, a lot of it has been, you know, especially in my 20s, when that is a time where you're kind of carefree and figuring out who you are and taking trips and being a little bit irresponsible. I didn't really have that because I felt like I needed to be very financially responsible. So I made those sacrifices where I couldn't take a lot of the trips that people were taking just for fun and seeing the world or spending money kind of frivolously, because I really had to think about every single dollar that was coming to my account. And you know, as someone who also came out of school with a certain amount of student loan debt, I was balancing paying off student debt, you know, sending money to my parents. And I actually, one of my first jobs out of college only paid me, it was maybe $20,000 a year for a couple of months. It was, you know, nothing really that you really could survive on. And I went into a little bit of debt at that, you know, point in my life, and realized I can't really do this, and I need to find a much better paying job, where I think a lot of people who maybe don't have that obligation are able to sort of take lower paid work because they think it's a good career opportunity. You know, you kind of can't do that when you're young in your 20s and in sort of my position. You know, I think a lot of people take unpaid internships, for example, because it gives them connections and things like that. But I could never have taken an unpaid internship just because I knew that there were people who were relying on me.
I mean, you share a lot about your own story here. You also talk to a number of people in a similar situation. Did you hear from people that their knowledge that they would one day be supporting their parents had shaped their career decisions?
Yes. So one of the people I talked to from my story, his name is Elaine Trung. And very similar to me, she was trying to find a job that would support herself and her parents. And she went into journalism and she got offered a job as a restaurant editor where, you know, she would be able to go to restaurants and try all these food and you know, do something that really delighted her in her career. But she had to turn that job down because it didn't pay enough. So she had to take jobs that maybe didn't interest her as much, but you know, was going to be able to provide her with that financial stability for herself and for her parents who she was supporting. And I think that is just something that people in my position have to think about all the time. You just have to make those sacrifices. You just have to take the jobs that pay you more, you know, even if it's not fulfilling in any way. And, you know, you know, after my story was published, I had a lot of people write to me and say, I went through this exact thing where, you know, for example, one reader, she was Korean American, or she is Korean American, and she said she grew up in Minnesota, the child of immigrant farmers who didn't have a lot of money and who expected her to support them. And like a lot of Asian American children, they were told to do really well in school because the expectation was you do well in school to get a great job. And so she did well in school. She ended up going to Harvard Law. And after Harvard Law, she went to a big law firm, and now she makes a lot of money. And she said, I make a lot of money not because I want to be a lawyer and because I love practicing law. I make a lot of money because I needed to do this for myself and to support my parents. It's not a labor of love. I'm not doing any sort of thing in my career right now because I love it. It's just a fact of my life that I needed to make this amount of money. So I think that is just one of the sacrifices a lot of us, you know, have to do. I think in a lot of other cultures here that don't have to deal with that, you know, children are encouraged to pursue their passions. And that is just not something that that I had to, or I, you know, I had the privilege of being to do, or, you know, following a passion, even though, you know, what I'm doing now, journalism, it is one of my passions. But oftentimes it's sort of the money comes first and then the passion comes second.
So I really appreciated that you covered this in the piece. I mean, if one exists outside of these cultures where this expectation is a thing, it's easy to maybe just assume that everybody is delighted to do this. And even if you do feel an obligation to do it, you're happy you can do it. It's complicated, right? I would imagine there are times when it's impossible not to be terribly stressed out and occasionally even resentful of these obligations.
Yes, and I do want to say that there is sort of this notion in the US that Asian Americans are this model minority who are very obedient and are very smart and do well in school and get great jobs. But there are a lot of people who are in this position who do feel resentful and who don't want to do this and actually have very complicated relationships with their families or have even been disowned because they've refused to, have this or to carry this burden of, having to support their parents. And I did talk to some few of those people for this story, but they didn't want to go on the record, obviously, because you don't want to go on the record with the New York Times saying, "My parents are a burden. I don't want to support them,"
Yeah, sure.
and you don't want. So, I wanted to mention it in the story that there are people that exist who are in my position who have sort of rejected that notion and they feel bad about it, but they just didn't want to have that in their lives. And sometimes you just make those decisions. Not every parent wants to pay for their children's college educations either, and they're just kind of like, well, it's on you. You take out loans if you want to go to the school that you want to go to, but I don't want to have that financial obligation. So it's kind of the decisions that you make in your life, and some of those people did talk to me, but they didn't want to be on the record, and I will say even personally for myself, I went into a little bit of debt. I think I mentioned a little bit before when I was trying to support my parents in my earlier 20s and I didn't make a lot of money. And I did feel as if life was really unfair and I was really, upset about the situation that I was in. But it was sort of there, I wasn't going to, make my relationship with my parents difficult by refusing to do it. And also, again, I had to remind myself that they went through untold horrors by coming into this country and did so much in their lives to create sort of the life that I have now for me, provide a lot for me, provide a loving home, provide a pathway where I was one of the first people in our family to go to college. And I'm an editor now at the New York Times. That is a success story. And I wouldn't have been able to do that without my parents. So I have to remind myself that they've made a lot of sacrifices for me, and this is one of the few things that I can do for them.
Mike, talking to lots of different young Americans about how they provide for their parents financially, you learn there are different ways to go about this. So it sounds like you maybe take care of your folks' bills as they come in. Other people have figured out it works better to send their parents a lump sum each month to cover expenses because it's possible to be supporting your parents and just like supporting maybe like a young adult child, you may not agree with everything they spend money on.
That's right. So with my parents, I told them, just give me all your bills. So I have access to all their online accounts. So I can see exactly how much money they need each month. I see exactly how much the electric bill is. When the electric bill is a lot more than it was the previous month, I ask them why, I like seeing those numbers and exactly what I'm paying for it because I want to know that every dollar is being used for a specific purpose. But in other cases, for example, one of the young women I talked to, Eli Trung, she mentioned that her parents would spend on things that didn't quite make sense for her. And rather than ask them, "Why are you spending money on this? Do I need to pay? Why would I need to pay for this?" She just says, "Don't tell me what you're spending your money on and what you need. I will just send you this exact amount of money for you to spend, and you can divvy it up as you see fit. And for her, that's what makes more sense. And but for me, I really like seeing the specific numbers.
How do families, or how do young people supporting their parents deal with times when they would like to do more but can't? Like, maybe you really feel like your parents deserve that dream vacation to Hawaii, but you cannot make that happen. Is that a common thing that you have to navigate?
Yes, I mean, I always want to provide my parents with more and more. And I think my parents understand and recognize that it is a little bit of a burden. So they don't want to ask more than what they need because they recognize that I am taking from my own vacations and things that I could be spending on my own. But, around the holidays, I will give them a lot more money. So that they can do the things that they want to do. So my parents, the thing that they love to do in their lives is ballroom dancing. And my parents met as ballroom dancers, and they see it as, a form of exercise, but also as a way to meet other couples, and it's very social for them. So they love to go out dancing and going to different cities and ballrooms to do that. So I'm very happy to support them and providing them with whatever funds they need. My mom in particular likes to buy different dresses, and I've gone to shops with her to help her buy dresses, pick out dresses for her. Or I mean, she picks the dresses and I just pay for them. But so things like that I'm happy to do. And for whatever things that they aren't able to provide for themselves, but give them joy, I try to make that happen for them. But yeah, they're not the type of people who want to go on these big trips or even like staying in hotels or even really like nice dinners. Whenever we've gone to a nice dinner, they're just like, we could have saved some money and gone somewhere a lot cheap, and you could have just given us the extra money instead. So that's the way they think about things. Yeah.
In families, Mike, where there are multiple adult children, you also have to figure out, right, who will pay what or contribute in other ways. So even if there are three kids, it doesn't necessarily mean parents' expenses can be just split in three equal amounts and paid that way. What have you learned about how siblings work these questions out?
So personally, I have two brothers, and so we have a lot of discussions about how to divide the expenses. And we each have different jobs that pay different amounts. And my younger brother is still figuring out how to live his life, so he can't do as much. But I live in New York, and my parents live in California with my two brothers. And since they're with them, although I'm able to provide a lot of the financial support, they can do a lot of things that I'm not able to do that might be a little bit more priceless in a lot of different ways. They take my parents to doctor appointments and, pick up groceries for them and just deal with a lot of the emotional things that I'm not there to deal with on a day-to-day basis. Sometimes they just need someone to talk to about something that's happening in their lives, or they need their medical paperwork translated into a way that they can understand what their doctors are telling them. Those are that a lot of that time is kind of priceless, and I'm not able to do that. But we have discussions about how we can each contribute, and I don't think that because my brothers aren't contributing as much monetarily that it's unfair because you're doing so much of these other things too. And some other people I talked to for my story, there's this one of them, this guy Tai Tran, is on a text chain with his two siblings as well, and talked a little bit about who would take care of their dad financially, and he would buy his groceries and do some of these other things for them. So it's always a conversation that you have on a day-to-day or month-to-month basis as everyone's situations change. Sometimes a sibling might lose their job or even get a better job and say, hey, I can contribute a little bit more. So it's important to constantly have this line of communication open.
So you mentioned earlier that your particular situation may have influenced you to become a financial journalist. I'm curious about how much guidance there is published out there for people like you who are born into this American way of doing things, still have financial obligations based on your family's original culture. Knowing how many first-generation Americans are in this country, I have to imagine there are millions, but I don't know that I see advice for people in your situation very often.
No, and that is a big reason why the New York Times hired me, I think, because the way that a lot of retirement advice is published is that people aren't saving enough. And we have this sort of idea that if you don't save for retirement, it's kind of a moral failing. And I wanted to show our readers and tell my story that my parents did not save any money for retirement, but it isn't a moral failing of any kind on their end. They worked really hard and they built a really great life. And you have to think about how people live in this country and how they got to where they are and sort of all the different cultural things that people experience that the sort of typical way of thinking about money in this country doesn't really fit into that box. So, obviously I want to provide a lot of coverage about how retirement works and how you can save for the future because I'm doing that for myself, but I do want to expand the way that people think about the way people do money in this country. So, I learn a lot about how people do money in this country and save and invest and pay off student loans, all of that. But I do want to start providing wider coverage of not only Asian Americans, but Black Americans, Hispanic households, Latino households. A lot of different cultures experience money in a different way here. So I think it is important to sort of show that people of all different backgrounds have different ways of living and spending money in this country. It kind of just shows sort of the diverse tapestry of how people live here.
Mike Dang is personal finance editor on the business desk at the New York Times, where you can find his recent article, Their Children Are Their Retirement Plans. Mike, this is really interesting stuff, and I so appreciate you making the time to talk.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can subscribe to our podcast. It's free wherever you get podcasts. You can also check out the podcast on our website, and you can sign up there for our new e-newsletter. That's at think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.